Good morning, everybody. My name's Lou and I'm an addict. I have to say, this is the finest group of sick people I've ever had the fortune to see. On behalf of the Plymouth Intergroup, it gives me untold pleasure to welcome everybody to the 2011 Drug Addicts Anonymous Convention, Recovery from Addiction. Firstly, we would like to give a very special thank you to Joakim, Erica and Dausko, who have had an eventful journey all the way from Stockholm to be with us here this weekend. I'd also like to thank everybody from all the other groups who have travelled from far and wide and near to make this great event possible. We have a fantastic day and a half event, which I'm sure everybody will enjoy. And it's all right, James. There's no need to look so worried. You've done a little bit of service this morning. Nobody's going to ask you to do another thing for another 6 months. Shortly, there will be free 15-minute shares from Nikki B, Steve and Nikki H, which will take us up to 12 o'clock. We will then have half an hour's coffee break. At 12:30, there will be 2 20-minute shares from our Swedish members, one from Erica and one from Joakim, and then 15-minute sharing from the floor, which will take us up to 2 o'clock, when we will have an hour's break for lunch. At 3 o'clock, there will be 2 15-minute shares from Simon and Joss, and then 15-minute sharing from the floor, which will take us up to the finish at 4:30. There is a literature table at the back of the left-hand side of the hall, and if anybody would like to buy a big book, Andy, could you just raise your hand a minute, please? Please see Andy, and he'll arrange one for you. The toilets are located at the rear of the hall. The ladies are on the left, and the gents are on the right. The fire escapes are on the left and the right hand of the building. You are permitted to smoke outside of the building, but can I just ask that the cigarette butts be put in the tins provided, please? And finally, can I respectfully ask that everybody is punctual and observes the time in the itinerary? And with that, I will hand you over to Manu, who is our secretary for today. Thank you.
My name is Manu and I'm an addict. Welcome to the Drug Addicts Anonymous Convention, Recovery from Addiction. Drug Addicts Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from drug addiction. Could all mobile phones be switched off or turned to a silent profile, please? Can we now have a moment's silence to remember Tradition 5? Each DAA group ought to be a spiritual entity, having but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the addict who still suffers. This is an open meeting, so could I please draw your attention to Tradition 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio and films. DAA is not allied with any outside organisations. Recovery is possible in DAA. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when using you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an addict. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I will now hand you over to Nikki, who has been invited to share for us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. My name's Nikki and I'm a recovered addict. Wow, what an honour today. What an absolute privilege to be sharing at our first DAA convention. You know, this is the first time I've ever been in a convention, and total privilege. I guess from an early age of teenage years, what I most picked up on was the inability, total inability, to form true partnerships and relationships with people. It wasn't something that I kind of dwelled upon, but I recognised it. Do you know what I mean? You hear it a lot of people saying it, you know, I felt an outsider, and that's certainly like what I felt, you know. And I found alcohol. And alcohol, you know, did it really ease me? I don't know. It's a bit of a difficult one. I just enjoyed it from the word off, do you know what I mean? I gravitated to the naughty side of things, and you know, and I certainly enjoyed it, and I found an inability that it sort of like released my inhibitions, that I could almost become a person that I kind of wanted to be, if that makes sense to you. I didn't know who this person was, but it certainly felt a little bit better than the person I was at that time, you know. And this total inability was the thread that ran right through my life, do you know what I mean? I would manipulate people. I was baffled all my life. I was baffled because I couldn't understand why I'd done the things I did. I was incredibly self-aware of myself. Do you know what I mean? We call self-centered. I was incredibly self-seeking at the same time. You know, I wanted people's appraisal of me. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be with the in crowd. Do you know what I mean? And I guess I couldn't really form that with sort of like normal people. So I stuck to the people that was doing what I wanted to do, you know, drugs, alcohol. And I felt more part of, more fitted in with that kind of like lifestyle. And, you know, I didn't have any aims or goals or anything as a teenager. You know, I just wanted to bumble on in life, do you know what I mean? Doing what I was doing, I was enjoying what I was doing. I wasn't having any sort of major consequences at this time, you know, why would I? I was a teenage girl, I was out having fun and, you know, and just having a laugh like other people that they was doing, you know, and I guess then you kind of like look around at your social circle and people are moving on, people are doing things, and I just want to carry on doing this. Do you know what I mean? I'm enjoying this. I'm enjoying this feeling that I'm getting, this, like I said, becoming a person that I thought I wanted to be. You know, I had an ooze of self-confidence about me when I was in, you know, under the influence of chemicals, and or I just didn't care. Do you know what I mean? It was that kind of case scenario. And but I came to a point in my life where I did kind of like want to settle down, and I wanted a bit of normality, you know. I could... dishonest of me, I know, but I could sense the shame of my dad and people like that. You know, I wasn't moving on, and I so wanted to, but I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it, or I could do it for a short spell, and then it would go back. Do you know what I mean? I just couldn't seem to form a normality within myself. You know, I was a very emotionally imbalanced person as well. You know, I'd go from one extreme to the other, and this confused me. It really, really confused me. I had no knowledge of what I was about, do you know what I mean? I had no knowledge of my nature in any sense or form, you know? And it was so easy for me, you know, now I understand this, you know, to point fingers at people and to blame, it's because of this that I'm like that, it's because of that because I'm like this, do you know what I mean? And I guess when you start, you grow up and you run out of options, do you know what I mean? That was the place that I came to when I had to start looking internally to myself, you know. I guess I didn't have a choice anymore, you know. I really didn't have a choice. I tried all the normal things of the relationships and the children and the jobs, and I still had this drug and alcohol problem. I couldn't shake it. It wouldn't leave me. I would stop for a couple of days, back on it. You know, well done, Nikki. Do you know what I mean? She managed to leave it alone for a little while. I'll have a glass of wine. And then off I go again, you know. And I tried everything. You know, the book tells us of, you know, changing your liquor. And I changed my drugs. And I moved the goalposts, you know. And the people I was with, you know, I didn't want to do what they was doing. But all of a sudden, I found I was doing it. Do you know what I mean? I just couldn't work me out at all. I was lost. I was baffled. And I was totally confused. And, you know, and the volatile relationships that I was in was just absolutely horrendous, you know. And I know, and I can see today how incredibly selfish I was, you know, unbearably selfish, you know. Everything was okay if it was going Nikki's way. And most of the times it went my way. I made it go my way. Do you know what I mean? I had I had to control everything. You know, I had to control all my surroundings. I had to know where I stood all the time with people. You know, this is my nature. I understand this today. You know, this is selfish and self-centeredness. You know, it corrodes me, you know. And in all this confusion, I had fear. You know, a big, massive fear of, I don't really know. It was just there. Do you know what I mean? Of life, of myself, of situation. Do you know what I mean? And it's not like, you know, I'm a little bit fearful today. Do you know what I mean? But it's not the case of like, I'm, you know, I'm sort of like consumed with it to the point where I'm sat in my front room and I can't move. That's the crippling fear that I'm talking about, you know, and I'll be on the phone to my mum, and I'm like, Mum, I've got to stop doing this. I can't do this anymore. I can't go on. And, you know, I look at my watch, and I've been sat there for like 4 hours. Do you know what I mean? Just engulfed with this fear. But I always had, like, an amazing ability. You know, my will, I'd shake it off, and I'd try this, or I'd try that, you know. But thank God, I was one of the fortunate people that, you know, finally, that straw that broke the camel's back, you know, it broke for me. I was coming into meetings, and I identified with you guys, but in the same breath of it, you know, I didn't want to be you. I mean, I had 20 years of drug and alcohol addiction, and then I'm sat in this room, and you're telling me that I can't use and I can't drink. It's like, what life am I going to have? Do you know what I mean? The book talks about, you know, boring and stupid and glum. That's what I thought it was going to be like, you know. And I'd go back out there, and I'd try control using again, control drinking again, and I'd wind right back where I left off, and it would just get worse, you know, until finally I was clean. I was clean for 6 weeks, and I had to have a drink. You know, I was horrible, worse than what I was when I was using. I was absolutely horrible. My mum, I was living with my mum at the time, and she used to say, I used to walk around with this big, dark cloud. I was like, urgh. Do you know what I mean? Everything was just so irritable, and I was unmanageable, and at one minute I was crying, the next minute I was shouting. I was just all over the shop, and I had a drink. And I cannot tell you the relief that I felt of just taking this drink was just immense, absolutely immense. And within 3 weeks, I was back, drug of choice, same behaviours, nothing had changed about me, and I was appalled by myself, absolutely appalled. And for the first time, that was when I had the choice, I knew that it was me. And, you know, people talk about the step one experience, you know, how dark and lonely it was. It was, but I had this, like, this shimmer of hope. Do you know what I mean? I just had a little slight shimmer of hope because I heard what you guys were doing. The seed had already been planted in my head. And I knew that I could just go back, swallow my pride, and just say, do you know what? I really need help here. Do you know what I mean? And that's exactly what I did. And I grabbed a sponsor. And she took me through the steps rapidly, thank God. You know, I don't think I'm not the type of person. I need to see results. I need to see results really, really quick. And I did within days, you know, absolute days. This is a 20-odd addiction of drug and alcohol. And in 2 days, I'm not even obsessing about drugs or alcohol. That is amazing. Absolutely amazing. I started, you know, doing things for people without, you know, thinking about myself, of what I was going to gain from this. Do you know what I mean? My sponsor, she put me into such good habits early of service, you know, thinking of other people, being there for the newcomer, ringing up newcomers. Do you know what I mean? Even though I was only like a few days in the door, I still had a little bit more to offer than that new person that just walked in. And my life was being lit in amazing ways. And, you know, I worked through the steps, and my life is just, it just keeps getting relit. You know what I mean? I wish I could say this in a few sentences, but I can't. My life today is absolutely immense, you know, from myself, from the self-confidence that I have, not arrogance. I have an inner self-confidence, you know, with my faith, I have a self-confidence. I have my self-esteem back, you know. I have peace of mind. My head's not rushing every 2 minutes. You know, I can actually sit there in my own time, in my own space, in my own skin, and feel okay. That, it's just amazing. You know, the book tells of miracles among us, and I certainly believe that I am one of them. Do you know what I mean? With the help of a power. You know, at first, my power was my sponsor. It was the group. You know, I didn't even care. Do you know what I mean? I'd just seen it all working for you people. You know, you had shiny eyes. You had big smiles. You was laughing. You know, you had productive lives. This is attractive to someone like me, you know. And I just followed what all you guys were doing. I stuck to my sponsor. And, you know, I started to reap those benefits, you know, real, real quick. And I still get them today. You know, I still get amazed of where my life's gone. I know it's not my doing. I'm convinced it's not my doing because I could never do it before. I've tapped into something so special, what I call God, you know. And with my program, the more I do this, the more my faith grows, the more my fears dissolve. Do you know what I mean? You know, I can be the mother that I've always wanted to be. You know, I was a good mum financially and in security, but emotionally I was not there. I'm not up and down anymore. I'm very flatline. I remember I used to say this weird thing, like when I was in addiction, I just want to be a flatline. I just want to be a flatline. Like there's not up and down, up and down. And people were like, what? I've got that today. Do you know what I mean? I've got that emotional balance today. I don't react, do you know what I mean, to certain things, like off my head. I can pause. That's meditation for me. I can pause. I can think about the situations. I can process my day. I can go back in the evening and I can review my day of where I can be a better person, you know, because that's what I strive for. You know, I am far from perfect, but I'm a million miles from where I used to be. And I still keep aiming to get to that perfection of my ideal of who I want to be, you know, and I will get things wrong, you know, and I will make mistakes, but it's what I do with those mistakes. I'm not going to demonstrate insanity and keep repeating them today. Do you know what I mean? I learn from them, and when I'm learning from them, I'm growing from them, you know, and, you know, these principles are just spiritual. You know, I have to be in constant thought of other people. Now, that goes, you know, in my meetings, that goes into my family, that goes into my work, it goes into all my affairs, you know what I mean? I have to be this person, and when I'm doing these things, you know, I'm at my best. You know, we was talking about it in my home group on Wednesday, you know, I'm sincerely at my best when I'm thinking of other people, and I'm not locked in my own crap, you know? And it's so simple and so easy to do if you're at that place of surrender, you know, because if you're not at that place of surrender, you've still got those nagging, it was for me, those niggling little, do you know what I mean? I might be able to do it this way, I might be able to do that way. When you've sincerely got no more ideas in your head, you know, that is the best place that, you know, I was, do you know what I mean? And I just jumped on board. And like I said, you know, my life is a ball. You know, it's absolute bore. I don't have dramas. I don't wake up in the mornings regretting the things I'd done yesterday. I look at my husband and I still love him. Do you know what I mean? These are the things that, I did, in my relationship. What the hell am I doing with you? Do you know what I mean? Because I was mad. I was totally and utterly insane, you know. And in my relationships, I don't look at what you can give me today. It's about what can I give you? What can I do for you today? I believe that's God's will for me. Do you know what I mean? He, peace and harmony, I'm sure that's what he wants me to live in, you know, and I do, you know. And guys, thanks ever so much for listening to me. It's absolutely fantastic to be a part of this, and thank you very much.
Thank you. And now I hand you over to Steve, who has been invited to share for us today. Thank you.
Thanks, Molly. I'm Steve, I'm an addict. Privilege to be sat here. I can't believe I'm sat here, to be honest. 12 months ago, I was sat on end of my bed, smashed, using. You know, I was really ill. Thanks, Jordy, for asking us. cheers. My experience was I felt lost as a lad. I always used to say, what's wrong with me? All the time I used to be, have loads of friends, but still feel separated from them. I picked drugs up, speed, when I was 15, 16, and it gave me something that I couldn't give myself, the ability to dance. it's true. Yeah, I thought I was brilliant for a while. I did about 18 months with that party scene, and I loved it. I love taking drugs. You know, I do. That's what's put me sat here today. I love taking drugs. Unfortunately, I don't take them like my mates take them, you know, my own friends. But I felt part of a little scene. We used to gather on a Saturday and get with drugs and party, and it was fun, you know, it was fun. And then I went through a period where I had, you know, a lot of people pick up at an early age and they're gone. I mean, I didn't. I was about, I always took more than other people. Always took more drugs than my friends, but I got to about 25 and I started isolating, fantasising about using in my flat on my own. Wouldn't it be good just sat on my own? And it sort of took over my life, and I was working full time, and it got worse and worse and worse. And when I tried to stop, I couldn't stop. That's what happened. My work funded my habit. I used to have to rob every day from work to feed my drugs. When I tried stopping, I ended up on a script, and I didn't really know what were up with me. I just wanted another way to get off the drugs. I ended up on a script, and every time I went in, I was positive for everyone as well. And they just said, you need to stop this using heroin on top of your script, you know. And I went, right, that's why I'm here, you know. So I had a methadone addiction, and, you know, it just spiralled, and I couldn't stop. I ended up in a daycare centre where we got picked up on a bus, and just call it behaviour bus. We got picked up on a bus, took to this place where they told me I was powerless, and I used to come back, and obviously I used throughout that daycare. I wrote a step one in my bedroom smoking stone, so I was in it when I writ it. It got worse and worse and worse. When I wanted to stop at that point, and I couldn't stay stopped, and it did get worse. I ended up in another rehab, a residential one, and I wanted to leave. I'd just done a Subutex rattle, and I wanted to leave. And he said, you're going to use. I said, I don't think I am, you know. And I thought to myself, I hope I don't. And they gave me £20, you know. And I thought, if I jump train, I hope I don't use that £20. And obviously, you know, I didn't have a clue what I suffered with. You know, and I got on train, I jumped the train, and I scored, and I were out there again. And this was just repeated and repeated. I had an absolute inability to stay away from that drug. And I kept it. Then it were hospitals. You know, that was my experience. Hospital food. I were obsessed to use in hospital. I remember, you know, my family had found out I were quite a secret user. I thought I were. Looking back, when I've made some amends, the people were well aware of what I were up to. But yeah, in hospital, I mean, I was really sick, and I was just wanted to get well so I could use. You know, absolutely frightening. I had started attending 12-step fellowships, and I used to do loads of service. As much written work as I could, and I had no concept or feeling of being powerless over this stuff. I didn't think lack of power was my dilemma. I thought it was lack of money. I thought, if I had a stack like that, there wouldn't be any problems in my life. But yeah, 12-step fellowships, and I was smashing them. I was doing whatever I could, and I can remember someone saying to me, you do right well, you got 6 brew positions, you know. And I was pouring brews thinking, I'm going to smoke stone as soon as I leave this meeting. I had to, you know. It brought me to a place where I'd done some work through Big Book, and I ended up back in hospital beaten, absolutely beaten. I couldn't continue. I looked face to face with myself and my addiction, and it was put to me on my hospital bed. My friend's here tonight, and he said, do you understand the seriousness of your condition? And I did. And are you willing to accept spiritual help? And I was just there. I was at that point. I felt beaten. And I got a sponsor, DAA, in Plymouth, which was, I don't know how that happened, to be honest, but I did. I went through to work. I was willing to go to any lengths. I was willing to do. I didn't question any words in book. I didn't question anything. It was just quick. I'm up for it. I was back to work full time again from being out of hospital, and I was getting up at 3 a.m. to do my suggestions because I knew I was going to use again. And when I went through that step one, it showed me that I was going to use again. Me on my power, I'd try and kill myself. That's my best thinking. And I had an experience with that because, when I looked at that, the physical craving, a lad at work said to me, a bit ago now, he said, how come you don't drink? Come on, tell us. And I said, because I'm allergic to it. He went, oh, right. He said, what, ration that? I said, no, I break out in the phenomenon of craving. And he went, oh, right. So... And I understood that, I understood that when I had a drink, my last relapse, last time I used, not the last time I used, but when I picked up, was a drink, and I just, the great obsession to drink like other people. I just wanted to be part and just have been normal. I hadn't accepted that I was an addict, I had a drink and, they were all stood there with the pints and I witnessed that physical craving, they were all drinking pints, laughing and joking, a lot of girls there. I wanted to be part of that. They asked me what I wanted to drink and I went, a big cocktail. And they were like, right, okay. So, necked that and I was just off. I was off and I was getting vodkas at end at bar and I was sniffing and I was knocking on the door of my, to score gear the next day, and that's what put me back in hospital. I couldn't stop. I looked at that physical craving and the obsession, the insanity to pick up clean. It's up here, it's in my thinking. And the unmanageability, that was amazing to look at that stuff on page 52 and totally identify what it was saying there. To say that I struggled with personal relationships and emotional nature and I couldn't make a living. I could go to work, but I couldn't make a living. Full of fear and all that stuff. I identified with that spiritual malady, that took me back and I couldn't sit with myself. I was disappointed in who I were, in what my life was like, and I was just ill with myself. I knew I was going to use again. I had no choice. I had no choice I was going to use again. And I went through the work. I carried on. I had that willingness to believe, and I was totally beaten. Throughout the steps, I felt beaten. I felt absolutely finished. And it was deep in myself, and I was blocked off, and it was like, right, okay. I didn't question anything. I just went through the work and made that decision to do that inventory and have a look at myself. Selfishness. I didn't think I was selfish. I didn't. I thought I'd give anyone a lift. I didn't care. It's not quite that. I think about myself quite a lot. I did that inventory and it was put to me throughout all that stuff, all the inventory work. It was an experience. I came down here to do it in March last year. And it was put to me, am I willing to turn to God with that stuff? And I was willing. I remember sitting back on settee and I was willing. And then through the rest of the work, obviously them amends, they were so important because I was told they were so important. So I went out and started making amends, and I've made amends. I had to sit with the managing director of the company where I'd done him for about 80 grand and sit there, face imprisonment, sit there and tell him exactly what I'd done. And he was just like, we saw you killing yourself. We just want you to be well. Come back and see us. Forget it. Come back and see us every few months and tell us how you're getting on and all that sort of stuff. And that last time I spoke to him, because I've been doing that action, he said to me, oh, we're starting a new company and blah, 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 and there's a chance it might be ringing you up and about some work and things. I'm like, what? Mental, crazy stuff. I made amends to my family, that were good. I made amends to my family, which is obviously ongoing. But when I made amends to my dad and spoke to my dad, he said, it's brilliant what you're doing. I ain't got a clue what you do. And I said, right, well, do you want a big book? And he went, yeah, okay. So I gave him a big book, and my mum said, oh, your dad's read that book 3 times this week already. I said, right, so and I spoke to him, and he identified with everything, apart from the physical craving, my dad. And then I went back again, and he started I started saying something about something on telly, and he said, resentment, cop. He said, pray for it to be removed. So I caught one with him. Well, I went, a fuming. It was brilliant, yeah. And I continue to make them amends. I haven't much money at the moment. You know, I'm working and everything, and I haven't much money, but I made all sorts of amends to people I've had fights with, and they started appearing from everywhere. You know, they started coming off buses, a lad who had a fight with 15 years ago, and all sorts of stuff, and it was crazy. I've done one for £2 the other week for a scone and a cup of tea that I ran out at cafe from. She was like, ah, she looked at me, I said, listen, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've had to go with this and see a desire to put right my past, because it says I'll use again. You know, to use is to die, and throughout the work, you know, I'm going to use again. I have to continue to do this stuff, and I have an inventory partner who, most nights we do an inventory together. You know, when we retire and we go through exactly, you know, I've been selfish, dishonest, resentful and fearful, and to keep me unblocked from that power that keeps me clean. You know, it's been an experience. I'm out there helping people. I do work in a rehab. I'm front line. I speak to lads in the street. I have to do this stuff, you know, taking people through work. A lot of my time is spent doing that. It's brilliant. My life's totally different. As I say, you know, I have an home group in Blackpool. I'm from Preston, to get that in. But it's an old football thing, that. But I'm from Preston, but I go to Blackpool, a DAA. It's a brilliant group, and I'm accountable to that meeting. We go through the big book. I'm sat here, you know. Can I say? This man still lives and is a free man. That's what it feels like for me, and it's an amazing experience. And just thanks everybody, and DAA, the big book. Thank you, know, God, that I'm sat here. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
And now I hand you over to Nikki, who has been invited to share for us today. Thank you.
I'm Nikki, I'm an addict.
Hi, Nick.
That's a bit scary. I was just thinking when Steve was going on about the dancing, that would be a good judge of people's recovery, wouldn't it? Get all the recovered addicts in a room, put a DJ and go, dance! And see who could dance. I'm here because I knew I was in a whole lot of trouble, and there was nothing I could do about it. And my life had shown me that over the years. I mean, childhood. I was right happy child. I had a really good upbringing, loving parents, etc., etc. But I know that when I got to be a teenager, it all went a bit odd. I couldn't see the point of life. You know, I didn't know what everything was all about, and I felt deeply unsatisfied. All the people around me, they had plans for the future, and, you know, they were going to do this, or they were going to marry their boyfriend, and all this, and all of this just seemed completely pointless to me. I was very, very confused at that point. I started using drugs in my late teens, probably, which was older than some people, and as Steve said, I could dance then. You know, it's that kind of thing. I was quite self-centred. I couldn't really... nothing felt right. I started using drugs, and it was like my whole world opened up for me, and I liked using drugs. But this isn't about, you know, those early days. I always look at this journey before I came into the fellowship as a journey from hopefulness. And I was always hopeful when I was young, you know, even when I was using drugs, to the point of hopelessness, which I got to. Early days, I'm using drugs. Like Nick said, I'm young, you know, there's not many consequences. It's all great. I can function in the world a lot better. I get on with people a lot better. And that feeling of pointlessness doesn't exist anymore. You know, I'm working, I'm paying for everything. But slowly, the drugs start to become more important than anything else. I was not aware of, really, when I was young, I was not aware of what was going on in my head, how I was feeling. I thought, that's how everybody felt. You know, how would anyone know how, you know, if you feel differently? I wasn't aware of that. I know now, in reflection, that I was different than other people. But, you know, I was working. I had good prospects when I was young as well, believe it or not. I was in a full-time job. I used drugs at the weekend. But the weekends started getting bigger and overtaking my whole week, so the weekends would expand. And in the end, I didn't have time to work.
you know, the drugs become more important than that. So I kind of left with a little bit of a push from my bosses because I wasn't performing very well at work. I left and I could devote my life to using drugs. But all the time I was hopeful. I just thought, this is something I'm choosing to do. This is a decision I'm making. I'm just being a little bit out there and a bit radical, you know, and going for it and being a bit of a face, which I thought I was, but I wasn't, you know. And it was like, Nikki's always got something in her pocket. And I used to like all of that. I used to like that. Because I always thought that I would, when the time came, as other people have said, when the time came, I would stop using drugs. You know, if I found the partner, or if I found the job, or if my mum got really, really cross, you know, if I had children, all of those things, you know, I would stop using drugs. I remember my first attempt at stopping. I was just thinking about this when somebody was speaking. My first attempt was at stopping. My partner phoned up my mum and said, could you come and pick your daughter up, because I think she's having a nervous breakdown. And I remember my mother saying to me, Nick, what's the matter? And I'm like, I don't know, you know, crying and that. I hate to admit I was crying, but I was crying and that. I don't know. I don't know what's the matter with me, you know. And It didn't feel good, you know. I was completely confused. I used again. I used, the only period of time when I stopped using was when I had my son, and I think that got me through it. You know, I could stop for a period if there was good enough reason, you know. But in the back of my head, I remember those days. I was always saying, yeah, when he's this old, I'll use again, you know, because I still didn't think it was a problem, you know. Obviously, I used again, and it started to take me into treatment centres. That's the only time, really, after that I ever cleaned up. First one I went in, I remember thinking, this is, you know, I felt a bit of a fraud. I thought, well, I don't know, you know, I'm not that bad. I don't really need to be in there. And I remember sitting in a group, and they're all sitting around talking about this, and I'm sitting there thinking, these poor people, you know, I'm just going to stop. You know, I'm going to leave out here. It would be madness to do what I've done previously. And I'm not mad, I'm a sensible person. I'm not stupid, I'm going to walk out and I ain't going to use drugs anymore. An hour. That's what I lasted, an hour. Because before I even got to the end of my treatment, you know, resentment was building up in me. Fear was building up in me. Hatred of everything, you know. Just that feeling that life, I didn't know how to manage life without drugs. That was my story, really, for quite a few years, in and out of treatment centres, you know, trying to clean up, thinking that this time it would be different, thinking, always not really wanting to stop completely. The thought of going through my life without using any drugs was a really frightening thought, you know. So my idea was that I'd go in and I'd get my head around it, get a handle on it, and then when I went out, I'd be much more sensible. And I would just have that one. And I would just use it weekends. And I'd just have a little one. You know, I remember once I come out and I thought, my flat's a mess. You know, I come out of treatment centre and my flat's a mess. I'm just going to have a little bit just to tidy up. Just to tidy up, because my life had got to the point where I was living in complete filth and chaos, you know. That was my story, you know, to be honest. You know, I've said before, you know, I was the one that never washed her hair and had one dreadlock, you know, because my hair saw water every 3 months if it was lucky, you know, because my drive to I didn't care about what I looked like, I didn't care about anything like that, you know, that's what it was. I realised, I think it was, you know, not this last treatment I was in, but the one previously, I realised that as much as I said to myself, you know, I'll come out and I'll do that one, I knew that if I put that one in my body, I knew, you know, logically, if I put that one in my body, that there was no way that I was going to be able to go, that's just it, and I'm not going to have any more. I knew that it would always be, you know, I'm just going to have it once a week, you know, and I knew that the day after I used, I'll be saying, yeah, but not this week. I'll start that next week. I could never do that. You know, usually I came out, I used, and I used every day. That was simple as that. And I knew that I would do that, and I kind of knew. But the thing is that after I, you know, knowing that is kind of not enough. Something happened to me when I come out. I could be walking down the road, and I'd know logically, you know, my son, I'm nearly losing my son. I'm evicted again. You know, I was a serial evictee because I could never pay my rent. My mum's not going to talk to me. My family were completely embarrassed about me, the way I looked, the way I was behaving. I remember once my mum said to me, my mum and my sister, they said to me, saw you in the town, Nicky. And I went, I didn't see you. And they said, no, because we was hiding. hiding behind a clothes rail because they couldn't even, you know, they couldn't even acknowledge that they knew me. They were so mortified, you know. But I knew that something happened to me. I'd walk down the road. I could be walking down the road. You know, yeah, I'm clean. It's supposed to be really good, but life seems pointless. I'm unsatisfied with everything. And something in my head would go, it'll be all right. It'll be all right, just this one time. I couldn't imagine life without it. Finally, I don't even know. I've said a few times, I don't even know why I came into treatment this time, because I truly believe that this was my lot. I was like 44 when I come into treatment. I've been using probably since I was about 17, so it had been, you know, a long period. My life, I always, for years, it was just trying not to let people know, trying to juggle balls and keep it sweet so people wouldn't kind of nag me, because I thought that, why can't they just accept that I am like this? There's nothing I can do about it. I knew for a long time there was nothing I could do about it. So pretty much before I came down this time, I'd given up any hope. And some of the reasons I came into treatment was because, A, I was getting evicted again. B, everyone was on to me. My son, you know, I'd not been a good mother to my son. My son was in prison looking at he was on a long jail sentence, still there now. And I was tired. I was so very tired of everything I was doing. I was tired of going through the whole routine. And I was tired knowing that this was going to be my lot. I was down the chemist on a Zimmer frame, getting my script, you know, and I'd kind of resigned myself to that fact. And I thought, what is the purpose of going into another treatment centre? There is absolutely no point, because I knew what I'd do. I knew what I'd do. You know, I'd be in there for a little while. You know, it'd all seem, you'd be on that fluffy cloud for about 5 minutes. I'd be really cynical about it because I knew it'd go. I'd walk out the door and things could be all right on the outside. It didn't really matter to me about what stuff I had, what stuff I didn't have. I'd had stuff and I hadn't had stuff all through my life, you know. But I knew the day had come when I'd use again. You know, and what is the point? What was the purpose for me? I used to think, what is the purpose of putting my whole family through it all over again? You know, all through that whole process of hope, hoping that Nikki would do it. You know, hoping that she's going to be a good mother, hoping that she's going to be healthy, hoping that she's not going to die young, really, because that's what my family thought. You know, what's the point of putting them through all that? Because I'm going to come out and I'm going to use. I was certain of it. I did the thing. I did the treatment thing again. You know, if anything, it was to give me respite from my using, which you know I'd done quite a few times before. In fact, going into treatment centres and stuff like that had saved my life physically. It gave me an opportunity to get kind of slightly healthy and go out for the next use up. I came in this time, and I knew. Because before I'd sat in groups, I'd talked about my issues and stuff, and I'd searched desperately for a reason why I was like I was, you know. That's what we do, you know. My life's in bits. I'm destroying everything around me. I'm destroying the people around me. And there's got to be a reason. There's got to be a reason why I'm doing this. You know, I was, as it says in the book, I was baffled, completely baffled by my situation. I was confused. I started going to fellowship meetings. I'd always been in and out of fellowship meetings. You know, my son's dad has been in a fellowship for many years and he's been clean. And I was always going in there trying to, you know, what is it? Why? How have they got clean? How have they stayed clean? It always amazed me when people would say, I remember listening to people saying, I'm 3 months clean, I'm 6 months clean. And I think, how do they do it? You know, how do they do it? But I'd never given myself to this. To be fair, I'd never heard the message I heard when I come to this meeting. The message being, it's about working the steps, you know. It's about that you've got no control over your using. Because I always thought that I should be able to get my act together and do something about it. You know, if I couldn't do it, who could? Then it was shown to me that I couldn't. You know, when all these things were explained to me and I read the book, I understood what was wrong with me. But anyway, I started going to fellowship meetings down here again, and I was a bit cynical, you know, and I used to go for a giggle and this and that. And then I started going to the home group I'm at now, and there was no messing about, you know. They were quite structured. They were serious about what they were doing. And they appeared to have recovered. They appeared to have to be leading good, honest lives. Because so many times I've been in fellowship and I'd seen people doing one thing and saying another, and I'd be like, nah. You know, straight away, addicts, we can pick up on all that. And then you kind of lose faith. I came into the meeting and I knew that there was nothing else left for me but to try this. I didn't know if it was going to work. You know, I didn't know. I'd tried many things before. I'd had trees, for God's sake. I've still got special stone. I've still got my special stone I picked up in one treatment centre. I have a special stone. Yeah, go out into the garden and pick something special that you really relate to. And a leaf and that. Shutters, mate. I've talked to trees. I've properly talked to trees. I've had people, yeah. I've even had needles in my ears, and I've tried everything. I didn't want to be like I was. You know, I didn't want to be hurting people. I didn't want to be so resentful with people that I'd be sitting in my room. And this is true, I'd be writing essays about how I'm going to kill them. But I'm not going to kill them. I'm going to torture them to the brink of death, then bring them back so I can do it again. That's what I was like, you know, that's what I was plagued with. I'm not a naturally caring person. I'm a selfish person. Only this program has enabled me to do that. I'm kind of leaping forward, aren't I? I went to the home group. I was 2 weeks before I was leaving treatment centre, and I was frightened. I was frightened. I thought, I know what's going to happen now. I know what's on the cards for me. You know, I'd been in meetings. I'd heard people talking about praying, and I remember that my head was so full of resentment with some of the other girls in the treatment centre. I was on my knees praying a lot. I didn't even understand why I was doing it, but that's the only thing that I could do. You know, I'd heard people saying, I remember speaking to somebody in a meeting, after a meeting once, and I'm still in a treatment centre going, what can I do? What can I do? Because I was so afraid. There's a small period of time. I knew there was a small period of time for me. I could walk out of the treatment centre. It could be an hour before that thing, the obsession hit me and I picked up that drug. I couldn't allow a second's grace, do you know what I mean? I was so frightened. Not because of what people had told me, but because of what I'd done in so many years past. That's what I'd done. Why would it be any different this time, you know? So I got a sponsor 2 weeks before I left, sponsor set up. I'd just do what they say. I don't know anymore. I haven't got a Danny out to sort myself out. You know, I didn't like the person I'd become. I didn't like the things I was doing. My morals were completely just unacceptable to me. My behaviour was unacceptable to me. I didn't understand about honesty. I'd been using heroin addict for so long that the lines of honesty and dishonesty are blurred. Everything I did, I thought was all right. I could justify anything I did, you know. But deep down, in a gut level, I knew it didn't sit right with me. Years and years, it all sat right with me. But my behaviour had become completely unacceptable to me. I got a sponsor, was given suggestions. I'm not going to sit here and say that life changed radically straight away, you know. But I remember 17 days out of a treatment centre, I'm sitting in a meeting and I'm thinking, I haven't picked up drugs. Miracle number one, because I'd never done 17 days before, you know. And I'm not sitting here thinking, I want to use. Like Steve said, I want to use, I want to use. And that had happened to me so many times. That wasn't going on, you know. I was told to turn up early at my home group. Didn't understand why. Got told off for being four minutes late once and thought, what's the value? Didn't understand all that. But I was so frightened and desperate that I did it anyway. I did all the things that were suggested to me, and then I started to work through the steps. I started to understand that I suffered from that physical allergy we speak about. I kind of knew it made sense. It all made sense to me. I used something, and that's it. It's all game over. I'm going to be using it the next day, the next day, and the next day, until I either somehow get put in a treatment centre or die. I knew that to be true. I knew that I was insane in the fact that everything I would be clean. Everything I had, there was hope, you know, my son would be coming back into my life, I'd have a roof over my head, everything would be kind of going rosy, and then I would think it was all right to do it all again and think the results would be different. I always thought the results would be different this time, always. And I knew that if that thought came into my head, there was nothing I could do about it. I was gone. You know, you hear people say that leave fellowship, people say, and I think Rich mentioned this the other night, was talking about it. If my head starts, they leave. If my head starts going, I'll come back. It's too late. My head starts going, I'm gone. You know, I want to live. I want to be a mother. I want to be a useful member of society for once in my life. I want to put something back instead of just taking and hurting, you know. As I said, I've got a sponsor. I followed the suggestions, didn't understand why I was doing it, was really embarrassed about praying, even though I was doing it on my own. You hear many people say that, but I was. But what am I doing? You know, what? Didn't understand God, and I'd sought... Oh, I've got 5 minutes. I do speak a lot. I'd sought God to help me before. I'd gone to churches and had hands put on me and all of that business. And you know, I even tried witchcraft once because I thought that'd work. Everyone I ate, I can put a spell on them. You know, that'll help me. I've tried. I know, you know, taking the mickey, but I've tried everything. This is the only thing that's ever worked for me. I'm 4 years clean, and it is a miracle because... That's just never happened in my life, you know. I followed the guidance of the sponsor, and I understood that there was nothing I could do about my disease. There was nothing I could do about my condition. And there was only one thing that I could do, and that was seek God. God, power greater than ourselves, you know. That's the only thing that could help me, you know. And that's how I try and live my life. I make mistakes, of course, all of us do. The idea is that I try and grow towards what God would have me be. You know, I try and be of use. I'm not a natural... I'm selfish, man. And sometimes in my work, we're kind of like... not care workers, support workers. And so I'm in the care business and I don't really care. The only way I can care is by... No, and I don't mean that, like, horribly or anything. But on my own... I couldn't even pretend to care. And that sounds really bad. I'm not really a horrible person. I have to seek God. I have to ask God's guidance. I have to ask him how he'd have me be. I have to hand my will over to him every day because I will become that uncaring person, that selfish person, that self-seeking person that I am without this programme, you know. Only anything I've got today... I'm working and stuff like that. That's a miracle. Even to be working, even to be able to get up in the morning without being really cross about it is a miracle, you know. Everything I've got today is by this program. It's not about coming in and talking about my feelings. For me, that may work for some people. It's not about coming and talking about my feelings. I've done that many times and it didn't work for me. It's about seeking God. It's about being of use. It's about being involved with this home group. It's about doing service in the home group. It's about getting our message. Something that I've been given a solution that's caused a miracle in my life. I am now here to try and pass that on to another person, to try and tell people that if they feel like I felt, if they were in the trouble that all of us were in, you know, there's a solution to that. And you know, it's in the big book, it's in sponsorship, and all of these things lead us to the power that we need, that we haven't got, that I haven't got, and that's the power of God, you know. And it has been, I'm really nervous, so I've probably gone really low, but I'm really nervous. It has been a privilege to share it, and I am very grateful, because who'd have thought someone like me, like a few years back, would be sitting here with a message to give, and hopefully to be able to maybe help somebody in some small way, then I've kind of done my job. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. I will now end the sharing and read the step 9 and 10 promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialise if we work for them. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Thank you to all who shared with us today. We will have a 30-minute coffee break in a moment, but would you please remain seated and join me in the serenity prayer first. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.